This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 353 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by, first, Rob Mark. He's a pilot. He's a flight instructor. He's an aviation journalist, and he's publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Oh, is that all?
I thought is there more?
No, thank you for that nice introduction, Max. It's nice to be back, and I'm glad everybody's listening tonight.
Yeah, you're just back from Brussels, aren't you?
Oh, Brussels, Montreal, Quebec City, Savannah, Fort Lauderdale, Sarasota. And that was just in 2 days. No. But way more travel over the last month than I've done in a long time.
All perfect flights, of course?
Well, except for the part where I had to fly on Air Canada, but that's... But then they are tied to United, so I guess I shouldn't have expected much.
Oh, yeah.
Don't get me started.
Okay, we won't. Also with us is Brian Coleman. He's our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Max. How's it going this evening?
Very well. You doing good?
I am, and phenomenally busy. There is so much going on in the world of aviation today. It was so difficult to choose what news stories to go over. And some of the ones that didn't make the cut, things like contracts at both Delta and United, a plane skidding off the runway in Buffalo, a man, I love this one, a man legally changes his name to avoid Ryanair change fees.
Oh, maybe we should.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
We should have brought that in. Yeah. I didn't see that one. All right.
We'll look at that. And there's just so much going on. It's crazy. And yeah, really looking forward to the show tonight.
Well, and let's not forget one very important story that didn't make it into the news tonight, guys, which is, of course, the fact that there was that great Vanity Fair story last week about Caitlyn Jenner.
That's an aviation story?
There's supposed to be aviation? Oh, okay. Never mind.
That's for a different show.
Okay.
All right. Well, we better introduce our guest before he bails out on us. So we'd like to introduce Anthony Nolly. Anthony is the executive producer and director of The Aviators. That's the independently produced television series that I think we all are familiar with. He's an instrument-rated pilot. He's a published writer. And this man has a passion for aviation, let me tell you. Anthony, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, it's great to be back on with the Airplane Geeks. It's been far too long.
It has. Anthony, I always thought that if Airplane Geeks was a TV show, it would either be The Aviators or a reality TV series, and I'm not sure which of those two.
Well, you don't want to go down the reality path, believe me. You guys are far too intelligent for that, but that's the last time I'm ever going to say that.
Well, that's good. But that's a good point, is that The Aviators is not yet another reality show in the sense that we're used to seeing on television. It's a great production. It's all about passion and aviation, and we just love it. And you just you're through your fifth season now.
Yeah, we're filming the sixth season right now.
All right, very good. Now, just so people are clear, The Aviators, it's on most PBS stations in the United States, right? It's also
right.
On Canada.
Yep.
And in other countries on Discovery Channel?
Yeah, largely Discovery on over 100 countries around the world.
And, of course, also online on places like iTunes and Hulu and Amazon. But we'll talk all about that coming up. We've also got some aviation news. Some of it, I hope, is as exciting as the news Brian's been reading lately. We also have an Australia desk from the Boys Down Under. and some listener feedback. But we're going to start off with the aviation news. And, you know, we had some emails flying around between us and I think one of our listeners about the intro music for the news segment. So try this out. First of all, we have to say, so is everyone ready?
Yeah.
Ready.
All right. Our first news story. Did you know what that was?
Some kind of radial engine airplane.
You knew it was radial. It's a Bristol Hercules, which was a supercharged 14-cylinder, two-row radial aircraft engine that was produced by the Bristol Engine Company starting in 1939. So there's a little different start out for our news segment. All right. Our first story, actually, we have some sad news. We have some links to some articles and also an obituary. Jeremy Monette died, the CEO of Sonix, as well as a Sonix assembly mechanic, Michael Clark. They were killed when their plane crashed near Whitman Regional Airport. Rob, you knew Jeremy fairly well.
Yeah, it's really sad. Jeremy and I were good friends. I mean, when we handled all the communications work for the airport for many years, Jeremy and I first met, that must be 10 years ago, I think. And Jeremy had come from Boeing, and he was a smart guy. He was a good businessman, and he really turned that company, he really turned the flame up, I would say, a little bit, and really started to make some impact in the world that it hadn't had before. Of course, Sonix was building an electric airplane. They have a jet that they're working on, and a few other things. And you know, again, as we called Anthony in our bio here, that, you know, he was the driving force behind the aviators. I mean, Jeremy was really the driving force behind Sonix aircraft. And so I was, of course, out of town. Unfortunately, I was in Brussels when I heard the news that his Sonix Acro had crashed right off the departure end of runway 9 at Whitman, and it was just awful to think that he was lost, because we had just, well, let's see, I think I left for Brussels a week ago last night, and he and I had talked on the Friday before about what we were going to do when we got together at Air Venture this year, and because we would usually exchange pictures with the kids and all the, you know, just good stuff. And so he's really going to be missed as a businessman, but also I believe that the airport is going to be, you know, at a greater loss, you know, with him being gone, because he was very good at being that driving force to try to help organize new business on the airport and try to help get Whitman Field better organized as a business entity. So he's going to be a tough guy to replace. And as I said, he was a good friend, and he's going to be, you know, very much missed.
Yeah, yeah. Anthony, you mentioned before the show that you were actually scheduled to do some filming with him.
Yeah, we rolled into Oshkosh with our crews, almost at the same time that his mishap occurred. And, you know, we were contacted by one of our producers saying, hey, gee, you weren't at Whitman filming this afternoon, were you? And we said, no, but we're looking forward to getting over there. And that's when we heard. And, geez, I mean, what a huge setback. And I think, you know, when the reality of it hits you and you hear that, you know, aviation, as wonderful as it is, does have a dark side, I mean, so to speak. I mean, it's a very human experience to lose a life to someone as passionate in aviation as Jeremy was. And I think for me, the thing that hit me the most is when when all the commentaries and publishes came out later on, there were some words published from his wife speaking to Jeremy about how she's going to look after the kids moving forward, and that was it for me.
Wow. Yes. Oh,
yeah, I saw that. It was so sad. And you know, he had a couple of young boys.
Right. Yes.
It's just, you know, I don't know. It's just Sonix Aircraft has a big booth up there every year, and I just can't imagine what it's going to be like without Jeremy there. Of course, his mom and dad are still going to be there. And, you know, his dad, John, was the one that started the company a long time ago. And John was had kind of evolved into the sort of the chairman emeritus and was doing a lot of the research on the electric airplane and the jet and all kinds of other things. And Jeremy was the day-to-day business guy. So I can't imagine where they're going to find somebody to replace him. It's just going to be hard to understand.
Yeah, it's tragic. Jeremy was actually our guest way back in episode 65, which was September 2009. We had a great conversation with him. Jeremy clearly very passionate about what he had been doing. We pulled a little clip, just a few seconds, Jeremy kind of explaining how important or what being a home builder kind of means to him. So let's just listen to this. This is from episode 65.
There's nothing like the feeling of being able to build your own airplane. And every time you look at it, you know, this is something I experience every day. Every time you look at this airplane and every time you fly in this airplane, there's something magical about it. This is something I built. And in my case, it's something I helped design and, you know, help run the company that opens this opportunity up to a lot of people. So it's a cool thing.
So we hope the family is coping. As you mentioned, Rob, two small children, that's always very tough. I think Jeremy was about 40, I think.
Yeah, he had just turned 40.
Ah, okay.
Just turned 40. And so it's nice of you to play that clip. And of course, we haven't found out anything yet from the NTSB. It's going to be a while before we hear anything at all, even anything preliminary about what went on. And so we'll just have to sit back and wait for that.
Right. And I know we have at least a few listeners that have Sonics aircraft, including Mike up in Massachusetts. And I know he's kind of reeling from the news, as I'm sure all of the extended Sonics family is right now.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Max. Well, Max, would it be appropriate to ask the people that have a Sonics to post the picture on our Instagram page?
Sure, that would be terrific. That'd be wonderful to see those.
Yeah.
I also understand that there is some kind of a memorial fund that the family is planning to create, and there are no details about that yet, but those just should be forthcoming. And when we learn them, we'll be sure to pass them on to all of you.
Sure, I'm going to be talking to the airport manager tomorrow anyway, so I'll see if I can get an update on that. Maybe we might have something before the show airs.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Rob. All right. Our next story comes from Reuters. This is United Airlines does not see a fit for Airbus A380. And United Continental Holdings has confirmed that they've been talking with Airbus about the A380, but they say the plane just doesn't work for them. Primarily, the A380 trip cost is more than using Boeing 787s. So this is kind of interesting. There are no U.S. carriers that fly the A380.
Yeah, in a way, this is kind of sad for me. Being a United frequent flyer, I would love to fly on United A380, but I certainly understand they seem to be doing everything possible to get rid of all of their 747s, and the frequency of running smaller aircraft is certainly much more convenient being a passenger going from point A to point B. But I think it also proves a point that Malaysian Airlines is having a heck of a time getting rid of their A380s as well. So it really does seem to be another nail in the coffin of the four-engine passenger jet.
Yeah, this is tough times for the four-engine jet. The economics just aren't there generally. Of course, that's not true for everybody. I mean, you take an airline like Emirates, and they're going gangbusters with the A380, but it's not an airplane for everyone.
I think Brian's point is well taken, that here in the States, every airline's getting – Delta's getting rid of its 400s. United is looking forward to the day when they don't have any more 747-400s. Of course, Southwest never had them. And neither really did America. I don't know. Did America ever have them? We may have a listener out there that could answer that. I don't think they ever did.
I don't think they had the 400.
Yeah, I have to think about that. But anyway, of course, the point is, you're right. I mean, they can run so many more, so much increased frequency with a smaller airplane and do it for a whole lot less money. And so it's, I think the, you know, people said when the 380 came out that it would never break even anyway. And I think that's probably going to be true.
There's actually quite a lot of a large number of considerations that an airline might think about when they're looking at purchasing aircraft. Obviously, a lot of it is operating costs, fuel, the maintenance, things like that. But it also can depend on other things like the routes that they fly. Some aircraft are more efficient to operate on certain routes. Some are more efficient with different passenger loads for the airline, things like that. And also, and we see a taste of it here with United, when they mentioned that, you know, they could, and this isn't how they put it, but basically they could stuff a lot of people into an A380 and just have some occasional flights versus having many more frequent flights with a smaller airplane like the 787, which gives their passengers more flexibility in terms of scheduling their trip. So a traveler preference can come into it as well.
However, yes, that said, go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say, yeah, I'm going to have to cash in my frequent flyer miles and fly on Singapore or Emirates in order to get on the A380.
Well, any flight on Singapore or Emirates is probably going to be fairly memorable.
But it is pretty cool when you're on the A380 and you get to walk up that set of stairs near the front end of the cabin to the second story or the second floor or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Because it's a wide staircase, big enough to get two people going different directions and they don't even get close to each other. So it's pretty big.
Anthony, have you ever flown on an A380?
I haven't. You know, we did a segment on the A380 in season one, and right. It is a behemoth of an aircraft. I mean,
it's big.
I mean, you gotta, just like, you know, with me and my former Warrior and 206 and 210, you need an aircraft that fits the mission. And for North American carriers, I guess there's not really a lot of missions for an A380.
That's true. And same with the 747. The article notes that there have been no orders placed by commercial airlines anyway for either the A380 or the 747 in 2014. Twin jets is generally a lot more efficient. Yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, we saw the tri-jets go away, right, for similar kinds of reasons. And maybe now it's time for the four-engine jets to kind of slowly fade away.
And the singles are coming.
And the singles are coming. Yeah, now I don't think...
The pilotless, you know, singles.
That's right. Yeah, no pilot and one engine. That would be fairly popular, I bet, huh?
Yeah, I'm going to buy that ticket right away.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we have an article from CNN. This is Commercial Airlines Industry Mixed on Imminent Emissions Regulations. According to unnamed sources, I always hate that when they're, you know, the sources are not named, but the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is supposedly to announce carbon emission standards for commercial aviation. Now, we don't know what the carbon limits will be, but we do know that the Obama administration had announced previously that it plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions over the next 10 years by up to 28%. So this seems like it could be a part of that plan. So I think the industry is a little bit nervous about, you know, what the EPA may come up with.
Well, and is this total emissions being cut, or is it emissions per aircraft? And if you have a plane like the A380 and you only fly it once a day, it seems like that would reduce emissions compared to running three 787s on the same route.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to measure emissions, right? Per aircraft is one thing, per passenger or per passenger mile.
Exactly.
Is something a little different. Whatever these end up being, one question is, do we need regulations, or are market forces strong enough? I think a lot of people said market forces are strong enough when the EU previously tried to impose emissions, a carbon trading plan for international flights. But what do you guys think? Do you think we need regulations in this area, or do you think market forces are strong enough?
I think if it wasn't for the EPA, the water in the U.S. would still be phenomenally polluted, and there'd be an awful lot of lead in the paint that we have. I don't see the industry doing this all on their own, and they need some pushing in order to make it happen.
I kind of agree, and I think what everybody's concerned about is that, as you mentioned, that carbon trading scheme they tried to put into Europe a few years ago, and I remember we did shows on that. The real problem was that people outside of Europe didn't have a problem with the European Union essentially negotiating the carbon footprint essentially that they wanted in their territory. But when they started trying to tell the Chinese that flying an airplane from Beijing to Paris, they were going to have enough carbon. What do you call it? Carbon credits. There you go. Thank you. And when the Chinese needed to fly an airplane from Beijing to Paris, that they needed to have enough carbon credits for the entire trip, when only maybe the last, 800, 700 miles was over European territory. That was really what drove people crazy. And the same with those of us here in the U.S. We would pay. We said we'd be willing to pay within the European Union, but not all the way from Los Angeles. And did they have the right to demand that anyway? And so the whole thing just came unglued.
Well, there's a lot of things that industry could do in order to reduce the carbon footprint, right?
Sure, stop flying.
Stop flying. No, but things like biofuel, right? We've seen many, many trials of biofuel in a variety of airplanes, and they all seem to be successful. That would have a big impact on carbon footprint, right?
Yeah, Matt, well, on burning it at the aircraft, but so I've heard, and again, I'm not a biofuel engineer by any stretch of the imagination. I've heard that it creates more carbon in making the biofuel than it does save by burning it.
that sort of shoots that argument.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of an issue there.
I guess so. What other things could the industry do, do you think?
Upgrade all the engines, get rid of all the old ones, and put in the more fuel-efficient, less CO2-emitting engines.
Sure.
Right? I mean, the folks at Pratt would love that.
Sure, we see, and also at CFM International, because we see the Pratt Geared Turbofan. They say that gives up to a 50% reduction in emissions. The Leap X engine, the CFM competitor, they frame it a little bit differently. They say a 50% margin on NOx emissions versus the CAEP-6 standards. So I'm not sure that's apples to apples. But in any event, both engines are claiming around 15% less fuel consumption. So that has an effect. But there's all kinds of things that could have impact that. Less time on the ground with engines running, right? We talked about the communication last time, I think, between air traffic control and the pilots using a text-based system that achieves that communication of flight plan changes much more quickly, so you don't have airplanes sitting around on the tarmac with engines running while they process the change. There's kind of a variety of things. It reminds me of, for those of you old enough, I know Rob is, of the back in the 70s when the EPA started creating fuel economy standards for automobiles. And everybody said that these numbers are wild. There's no way to achieve that kind of reduction in emissions or improvement in fuel economy. And guess what? Eventually they did. It may be the same thing here.
I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
All right. One other item. This is from Flight Global. EasyJet tests UAV with A320 inspection. See how I snuck a drone story in here? And I was going to do this on the UAV Digest. Yeah, I know. But it's kind of interesting. So this UK company, Blue Bear Systems, they're working with EasyJet to use what they call this riser quadcopter. The RISER stands for Remote Intelligent Survey Equipment for Radiation. What does radiation have to do with it? Not much, but I guess that was the original design or the original intent or mission for this quadcopter. But now JetBlue is looking at this to perform aircraft inspections.
It seems like it makes sense if you need to inspect the top of the aircraft or something on the tail. I mean, something that's not easy to get to.
Yeah, I think that the article talks about looking at detection of damage caused by lightning strikes, and that's something that you have to physically manually do. And this is a more efficient and faster way to do it. Just send this little quadcopter up and circle the plane. Of course, you got to ask yourself, well, okay, is it safe if we've got an airplane on the ground in the at the airport? Now you've got little quadcopters flying around. Does that represent a safety issue? I thought one of the interesting aspects of this, technical aspects of this little device, is that it's got sensors and software on board, so it keeps the quadcopter 1 meter away from the airplane, so it won't strike the airplane.
Yeah, that's not going to help the engine inlet, though, is it?
That's right. It's going to get sucked in.
Be on in order for this thing to do its inspection?
Hopefully not. Probably that would be part of the process.
I was just saying, though, that even a neighboring aircraft, just have the engine suck it in. That'd be fun.
All right. So here's another application for little drones. Anthony, you haven't done an episode on drones yet, have you?
No, that's on our docket for season 6. And I'm not sure we're going to get to it this season, but we definitely want to. We have a big interest in drones. As a matter of fact, we have a Phantom 2 Vision Plus that we really, really like. But it has sat awfully quiet for several months right now because, quite frankly, I'm afraid to fly it because of where the regulations are or aren't at any given point in time. I'm not sure if I can fly it.
Yeah, no, technically you can't, at least according to the FAA, because that would be a commercial use. And unless you have an exemption and met some other requirements, technically you're not allowed to use it in a commercial context like that. Of course, a lot of people are, and some of them get in trouble and some of them don't get noticed. It's a very difficult situation because so many folks, including the industry that you're in, Anthony, are just chomping at the bit to use these little drones to get some really good shots. But
yeah, I got to tell you, I really got to think that we need to look at drones as small as like a Phantom 2 or the new Inspire that's come out.
Yeah.
And we have to look at those as camera platforms or as toys or as instruments or tools, such as with this article. I really don't think that we can look at those things as aircraft. And truly, I know they are. But then again, if I fold up a piece of paper and throw it across a room, is that an aircraft as well? We have to draw the line. And I think, if we can program these things so that they they're already intelligent enough to stay away from airspace, protected airspace, if we can limit the height and limit the speed and limit the distance away from the operator, all of which can be done, why can't we just let these things go wherever they want to go? And I think the people who say privacy is an issue and, you're going to fly your drone into your neighbor's window and look at what's going on there. I mean, sure, you can do that now with binoculars or night vision goggles. You don't need a drone if you want to be a creep.
Well, can I throw one thing in there? I mean, Anthony, I'd like to ask about your comment there about the fact that these things are smart enough to stay away from protected airspace. That's a new one on me. I had not heard that. Maybe certain aspects of some of the military drones are, but the little ones? I mean, we just had an incident here down in Dallas last week where a Southwest airplane on final going into Love Field came, wingtip to wingtip with a drone at 2,500 feet.
Well, that's
Class B airspace, or Class C, I should say.
That should never be allowed to happen. That is definitely a gigantic problem. And all you've got to do is put an aviation database inside the drone. And if it's going inside any of the rings or forget going inside the rings. Give it a huge latitude. It can't go anywhere near any of the rings. And if it does, it does an auto land or return to home or any number of things that you can do. And sure, people can bypass that. But then again, you can give someone a harmless instrument and they can do something really stupid with it. And unfortunately, there's no law against stupidity. I wish there were.
All right. Well, again, we're speaking with Anthony Nolle. He's the executive producer and director of The Aviators. Anthony, is the show meeting up to your expectations? When you go back five seasons ago, and think about when you were just getting started with this show, is it where you anticipated it would be?
Yeah, you know, it's really been a wild ride for us. When we first got the show going, we were thinking if this thing had hundreds of thousands of viewers around the world at its peak, we were really doing a good thing. And now we're in over 100 countries and we can boast over 50 million viewers around the world. Those are crazy numbers. Unfortunately, we're not a big Hollywood name. We're not a huge production company. And if we had numbers like that and we were names, then we'd all be stinking rich and big operators, and we're not. But you know, that's what happens when you do a television show on aviation, I guess.
Yeah. So you were asking a question?
I was going to ask Anthony if he thought that he'd still be on the air 5 years later.
I'm not sure I planned that far. I certainly wanted to be on the air after 5 years, and I'm glad that we are, and I'm glad that we have other shows under our belt now and other projects that we're working on. I'm just really proud to, you know, when we started this thing, I didn't have very much of a television resume, and I think I've got, you know, a little bit of one now, and I'm just glad to be playing the game. You know, it's a lot of fun. And over the 5 years, I got to tell you, some of the stuff that we've found ourselves in with and people that we've met along the way and stuff that we've done. I mean, our crews have flown with the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds. We've spent time with Sean Tucker and Patty Wagstaff. We have done flying lessons with Motley Crue's Vince Neil. I mean, I couldn't have told you 5 years ago that any of that stuff was going to happen. So it's been a wild ride.
Anthony, I saw the episode with Sean Tucker. You mentioned Sean. That was, I think, episode 2 from season 5. And I found this absolutely fascinating because here's this air show performer, and you have him describing his routine. I mean, physically, he's on the ground, he's describing his routine, and you're showing kind of split screen, is that what you would call it?
Yep.
The aircraft as well. And as he's describing his routine, it's like a dance. You can watch him visualize it. You can watch him perform his routine, you know, in his mind. His arms are waving. He's dancing around. He's pivoting around. Did you know that he was going to do that when you started that that project?
No, actually, we just wanted to interview Sean Tucker. Well, because Sean Tucker is a performer. This guy is on when he's awake. if he's in his aircraft, it's an unbelievable aerial performance. But even if the guy is just standing in front of you ordering lunch, it's a performance as well. This guy is the consummate showman. So we just wanted to spend some time with him and just learn from him. We just wanted some of that energy to come across. And not only did it come across, I mean, we ended up doing a segment for season 4 on Sean Tucker himself, because he's a big, big personality. But he started going into so much detail in that same interview on every single aspect of his routine. It really gave us an appreciation. I mean, I'm not an aerobatic pilot. And when you go to an air show, especially something like an air venture, when it's one performer after another, after another, after another, after another. I mean, if you're looking for the bathroom or looking for caramel corn, you start to almost forget that there's pilots in airplanes doing incredible things up there. It becomes a little bit ubiquitous. And nothing that is going on in the sky is happenstance. It's not cavalier. Every single thing that especially a Sean Tucker does is meticulously planned. If he zigs instead of zags, that's because he wanted to zig instead of zag. Everything is very, very deliberate. And it was during that interview when he started to really live the performance on the ground that we thought, wow, we need to put this side by side against the performance as it's actually happening and give the viewer a much better, I think, a much better appreciation yes. of what's involved. And I mean, that's what I got from that segment.
Yeah, it's got to be one of the most instructive interviews I've ever seen. And if you're at all interested in air shows or performances or just, you know, what goes through the mind of a pilot who's got some amazing skills and abilities, this is just a must see. It's really fascinating, really fascinating. Any other sort of memorable experiences from the fifth season?
Well, from the fifth season specifically, this will be a little bit of a hit and miss one, but we did a two-parter where I specifically attended flight attendant school.
Yes.
And I guess I came off as a little bit of a boob on occasion, but I got to
no,
tell you.
No, I don't think so. No, no.
Well, I mean, the Anthony that you see in those segments is the real Anthony. I mean, I'm not hamming it up at all. I'm an ordinary guy. I have my brilliant moments and I have my not so brilliant moments. And and I think when I'm not very brilliant, I think I'm a little bit entertaining. So you just go with it. But that was a hit and miss one because, I mean, we have a lot of viewers that watch the show because they want to see airplanes. And some of them don't really care too much about flight attendants and whether or not they're important. But on the other hand, other people got a real kick out of those segments, that they really enjoyed them, that they were fun, that they learned a lot. And in fact, we had one viewer contact us and say, you know, I was deathly afraid to fly, and I watched your flight attendant ones, because we go through some emergency scenarios and how the flight attendants are trained to kind of work through the situation as best it's going to turn out. And it really, it's the fear of the unknown that for this one particular viewer that made them afraid of flying. And that really helped show them a lot of the unknown, made it a little bit more known. And that very viewer ended up going on their first commercial flight afterward. And now they're a flyer.
So you made a boo-boo in one of those simulations, right? The simulation was that the plane needs to be evacuated and your job was to check the door before opening it. And what did you say?
Yeah, you're supposed to check the door before you open it, because as if there's a fire in your house, you want to, you know, sort of touch the door handle. You don't want to open that door if there's fire, because you'll let the fire come into the room of your house that you're trying to escape from. Well, it's the same in an aircraft. So there's multiple exits, but the last thing you want to do is open a door only to have, you know, a huge ball of fire come in and roll down the inside of the aircraft. So I was supposed to check the door that I was nearest to verify that it was clear, and I was told that there was a fire. So, of course, I verbalized that, which is probably not the thing to say. I should just very calmly direct people to an alternate door. And, well, that was one of my Anthony moments, I think.
Yeah, you say fire on an airplane. Even if there is a fire, you're going to cause some panic, I think.
Yeah, probably not the best choice of words at that particular moment.
Yeah, yeah. And the flight attendant school, that was Flight Attendant Express, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, in Orlando, Florida. We weren't supposed to identify the airline that we were on, so we were careful to sort of avoid the branding. But it was Flight Attendant Express that did the training, and their mandate really is to equip people as best they can when they want to go in for a flight attendant job to sort of be as pre-trained as possible.
Yeah, one of the interesting parts of that, and I think this followed the experience where the simulation where you said fire instead of exit blocked, is that the instructor there said that what the flight attendants need to do is give instructions. Don't waste time describing what's happening. Just give instructions, give directives to people to act, because in an accident or some event like this, seconds really count. So her point was, don't waste time adding more details about the situation. Just give orders and make people execute those orders. I thought that was very interesting.
Barking commands. I mean, she was literally barking commands. Yeah, yeah, and, you know, yeah. On the receiving end of that, I mean, I tried to do a little bit of acting and try to take myself away from the fact that it was a simulated scenario and tried to put myself in, you know, a real scenario. And I was probably not 10% of how real a real scenario would be, but I tried. And it's, I mean, you have your seatbelt on, you have to, you know, try and stick your head into your knees and do all sorts of things. And if the flight attendant isn't barking those commands at you constantly, you're really not thinking of what to do next. And I think the biggest lesson is, how many times have you been on an airline or a commercial flight and you know, oh yeah, I've heard the briefing 20 times, 50 times, 100 times, and you don't pay attention, or you flip through the magazine, or you can't. Why do they do this every single time? The reason they do it every single time is because they need to drill it into your head, because in an emergency, you're not going to remember the fact that you heard it a month ago or 2 months ago. You're barely going to remember the fact that you heard it half an hour ago.
Yeah, and I think that really reinforces the point over how difficult the job is of a flight attendant, and truly that their job is to save your butt and not kiss it. They get so little respect for what they do. So I'm really glad to see you focus on that and really highlight what they have to go through.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's part of why we did it as well. How did they explain it to me? You know, 90% of what they do is cater to the passenger, serve drinks, you know, give snacks. But really, it's a minuscule part of their training.
Now, there was an episode this past season where you interviewed Jetman.
Yes, Eve Rossi. That's just a little crazy, I think. I mean, this guy mounts himself to the side of a helicopter, goes up several thousand feet, and then just basically drops backward. And he is wearing a wing powered by a couple of jets. I mean, he can't do a very long cross country on it or anything, but he is the aircraft. And I mean, I've never jumped out of an airplane to go skydiving, so that whole notion of departing a perfectly good aircraft is just crazy to me. But to be, I guess, your own aircraft is truly remarkable. And we did an interview and filmed him during his performance at AirVenture a couple of years back. And it was a tough performance to watch for anyone that might have been at AirVenture catching it, because, I mean, he's so small. He's a speck in the sky. He's a couple of thousand feet up. And that's why I think the video and the segment are probably a better way to see him, because you're there kind of with him as he's 2,000 or 3,000 feet up, rather than being 2,000 feet away trying to really appreciate what it is he's doing. But yeah, he's a truly remarkable guy, and what he does, I got to say, is maybe a little bit nuts.
All right, you said it. I was thinking it.
Not a little, an awful lot.
But that's all right. I mean, yeah. I mean, aviation is punctuated by people who do kind of sketchy things, and it leads to, you know, interesting results.
If it weren't for the crazy ones, you wouldn't be able to spot the sane ones.
That's right.
Yeah,
guys like Rob, for example.
You know, I knew you were not going to let that slide. I just knew it. But that's okay. I forgive you guys.
All right. So what else, Anthony? What is this thing called AirBoss? What's that all about?
Well, you know, back a few seasons, a segment called Behind the Scenes of an Air Show. And we were going to feature Mike Wiskus, who flies a wonderful little biplane. And sort of what he does to get ready for a performance and then execute the performance. And Mike suggested that we should probably get in touch with the air boss, because the air boss is in the middle of everything at an air show. So we thought, yeah, okay, that sounds pretty neat. Maybe we'll have a 2-minute offshoot from this segment into this air boss person, see what he does. So he introduced us to Wayne Boggs, who is Wade Boggs of the Boston Red Sox, his brother. And he's the air boss of the show that Mike Wiskus was at there. It was at Sun and Fun a number of years back.
And, you know, we thought we'd film with him for a couple of hours, see what he's in the middle of, do a quick little interview, and there's your two-minute offshoot. But I'll tell you, the air boss of an air show is in the middle of everything. I mean, to say he's in the middle of everything is one thing, but to actually see that he is in the middle of darn near absolutely everything, short of, you know, whether relish or ketchup should go on the hot dogs. I mean, he's involved in everything else from a flight standpoint, from a safety standpoint, from an aviation standpoint. And that offshoot, that two-minute offshoot turned into its own segment, turned into an entire episode, turned into two episodes, turned into its own show called Air Boss.
So is this something that we're going to see more episodes of in the future?
Well, we actually have filmed six episodes of Air Boss, a dedicated series starring Wayne Boggs. And it is airing in every continent around the world except Antarctica and North America.
In North America.
Yay, us.
We've been talking to broadcasters for several months, and there's been a lot of interest, but it's really funny with we're finding with aviation and with air shows in particular, broadcasters in North America have sort of touched that space with limited success in the past, and they're not quick to jump on board with Air Boss. So despite the fact that we've gone down a path in North America that a lot of broadcasters have shown a great deal of interest, none have opened the door wide enough to make a home for Air Boss. Now, we can give it to PBS, no problem. We've got a great relationship with public television. But I don't want to do that yet, because the minute you do that, then that's it. Air Boss is on PBS, and that's where it's going to be forever. It's on Discovery, for example, around the world, in every other country that it airs around the world. So we really want to find a more commercial home for it. Where you can see Air Boss in North America right now is on iTunes.
Oh.
And we really love the show. And it is a little different from Aviators, in that Aviators is purely information. We don't really hype up any kind of drama. It's all just looking at beautiful airplanes and having appreciation for what they do and seeing cool things and cool people. Air Boss does go down sort of the reality show path a little bit. Now, the difference between reality TV, the way you might see it in, you know, Duck Dynasty or Wahlburgers or what have you, and something that you might see in Air Boss, is we like to think that the viewer has some intelligence. You know, we don't want to insult the intelligence.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, we don't want to insult the intelligence of the viewer. There's a lot of things that I've seen on aviation reality TV shows where, as a pilot, I feel, okay, listen, that would never happen in a million years. I know that. So now you're kind of treating me like an idiot, and I don't appreciate being treated like an idiot. So we don't do that with Air Boss. We figure aviation is filled with so many things that are naturally exciting, and air shows are filled with so much natural drama that we don't need to amp anything up. Basically, we just need to let the stories play out as they're playing it out. Sure, we pump up the music a little bit, and we tell the story in just the right way, just to keep things flowing and keep it interesting. But I'll tell you, anything that you see on Air Boss happened. We didn't make anything up. We didn't fabricate. We didn't embellish. It's about the most real reality show you'll ever see.
You know, I got a taste recently for just that level of drama that is associated with being an air boss, because I don't know if you're familiar with Steve Tupper, but he's the host of the Airspeed podcast. And Steve has done a lot of things in aviation over the years. But one of the things he's doing is he's trying his hand at being an air boss for an actual air show. And some of his episodes on airspeedonline.com, he's related his experiences, the challenges, the drama associated with trying to pull one of these things together. And let me tell you, it is not easy. And, as you say, Anthony, there's an awful lot that goes into it. And Steve is really, well, enjoying / suffering through it in a big way. So, yeah, I'm absolutely convinced that Airboss would be a fascinating series with a lot of interesting stuff. Things you just don't see and you're not aware of if you're just watching the performances.
Yeah, you really have no idea. I mean, it's usually a small cart or a trailer that the four or five people are standing on top of at show center, and everyone's looking up. No one's looking at the air boss, and really, it's not like he's doing tricks up there. He's doing what he does, but it's really nothing to look at if you're a spectator at the air show. But if you have the opportunity to watch Air Boss and understand that it's more than just the pilots turning the keys, going up, doing a couple of tumbles and coming down. I mean, this thing is orchestrated, and this is the conductor of the orchestra.
Hey, Anthony, one of the things that I have to do in my job here is find guests. And I think I would love to have your Rolodex because it would make my job so much easier. How do you find these people that you do these stories on?
Well, we get a lot of emails and a lot of suggestions, a lot of invitations, and between Facebook, we have a lot of fans on Facebook. We get a lot of people contacting us via email and messaging us in various ways. And just so people know, we read and respond to every single one. We really, really, truly do. Now, we don't necessarily take every suggestion and run with it, because I mean, there's a lot of things that make some suggestions more feasible than others, but it all goes into the big mixing pot there. And then we come out with what we come out with. And what we've learned from our viewers is over the past few years, we've told some stories that, that are a little bit more involved, like where Airboss came from. And we've gotten away from, but we've focused a little bit less the past couple of seasons on simple general aviation aircraft. And I think you're going to see that in season six. We're going to come back and focus a little bit more on general aviation aircraft. So how do we find these segments? You go to any airport in small town USA and you walk up and down the rows of hangars and there's interesting stuff there. There's interesting people there, and you just start talking to them. And if you can show some remarkable airplanes, go flying in them, talk to the people who fly them, talk to the people who build them, talk to the people who maintain them, then there's no end of segments. As long as there's another airplane in another hangar at another airport, then you've got more segments to do.
I think one of the more interesting segments I saw, you guys focused on the guys, I believe they were in Texas, that build engines.
It's like Continental.
Yeah. It's like getting the president of Continental to be on Airplane Geeks, I think would be fantastic, and just talk to him about engines.
Yeah. I mean, we do talk to some high powered executives, and they're going on television, so obviously they come out of the boardroom and they, put on their shop clothes and they look like they're, working on the floor every day, but they haven't been down there in a long time sometimes. But they're representing the company, and I think they do so very, very well. I can't say that I, talk to these people routinely and that I can just call them up and say, whatever. But I'm glad that they, when they open up their companies to us, that they make themselves available and share the history. And I think the pride, every time you talk to one of these high-powered execs, it is clear that they are motivated and inspired by the work that they do and by the people that they have working for them. It's that comes out more than anything else, I think.
Well, one of the things that struck me about that particular episode with Continental Motors was that, I was interested in seeing what their shop looked like, because I've been in an awful lot of jet engine shops, been in manufacturing facilities, been in airframer factories, all of that. And I was interested to see what does a shop look like from, at least by those standards, sort of, I hate to use the word small, but, relatively small company. And you know what? It looked just the same. I was just surprised at how similar to a jet engine factory it looked. You know, the manufacturing methods they used, the manufacturing cells, forgings turned into finished parts, the whole manufacturing process there looked very familiar, very aerospace, very world class to me. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And that's one of the things I like about the Aviators so much is that, like we try to accomplish on this show, you know, you're educating us, the listener, the viewers, in your case, showing them things about aviation that maybe they didn't understand or didn't know about. It's just sort of educating and informing, and in the case of flight attendant school, maybe even entertaining, you know, the audience. So I think that's great. Tell our listeners where they can find the Aviators online.
You can visit our website at www.theaviators.tv, or you can check us out on Facebook at The Aviators TV, or even our YouTube channel, The Aviators TV.
Very good. Appreciate it, Anthony. We'll have to have you back on more frequently than we have in the past.
I'd love to be back.
Hey, you guys going to have a booth at AirVenture this year?
No, we're not. You know, we've done the air shows between AirVenture and Sun and Fun so many times in the first five seasons that they really are the most challenging places to shoot. And with more shows that we're working on, we've got three projects that we're working on right now. We honestly don't have a week just to hang out at an air show unless we're filming stuff, and we're just not filming at air shows anymore. It's just too crazy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So getting a bunch of interns and having them sell the DVDs, that's not a profitable thing for you to do, or?
Well, you know, it sounds like it's something that's simple to do, but someone's got to coordinate that, and someone's got to go and oversee it, and you know, we are a small team, and you know, we can only dedicate people to so many things. And we did that. I think our last run at Sun and Fun, we did send sort of a scaled back team. And if you're not going to put on a big show at something like AirVenture, it's almost not worth doing it. You know, you really you can't give a half-assed effort. You've got to give a fully assed effort.
Both cheeks.
and we just can't do that. I've been filming three TV shows. So, I mean, we've got to, that's really where our attention has to go.
As you know, the Airplane Geeks podcast is a labor of love that has always been free to anyone that wants to listen, and the geeks plan to keep it that way. Over the years, though, there have been significant costs associated with producing it. Some of these things are rather invisible, or in Airplane Geek parlance, stealthy. Some technical expenses are not even very easy to explain, things like media and website hosting services. Then there's the physical equipment, like recording gear. And with the geeks bringing us stories from outside the studio, there's field reporting expenses as well. These costs have always been borne by the hosts, and more recently, with the help of a few small sponsors. So we're asking if you'll help by going to airplanegeeks.com and clicking on the donate button. Now understand, we're only asking you to do this if you can. If you're saving your money for flight lessons, for higher education, or if you just can't afford to make a contribution, that's fine. We want you to continue to listen and be a part of the Airplane Geek community, a group of people that I'm very proud to be a part of. But if you can, would you please take this opportunity to help keep this great show on the air and free of advertising? The Airplane Geeks love their listeners, and if you're like me, this great show is more than just a podcast. It's a group of friends from all over the world that you've just never met. Keep listening to the show, and keep telling your fellow aviation geek friends about it. And if you can, and only if you can, please support this amazing podcast by going to airplanegeeks.com and clicking on the donate button now. Thanks in advance for your support. For the Airplane Geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 8th of June, 2015.
Well, g'day, folks. Welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 353 on this long weekend here in Melbourne, or here in Australia, I guess. It's the Queen's birthday long weekend, Grant, and I always find that interesting because here we are in June, and I believe the Queen's actual birthday is in April.
Yeah, well, it's like President's Day and all that kind of stuff. You just got to pick an arbitrary day and go for it. And the good thing about the Queen's birthday long weekend, aside from getting the chance to go out and fly for some lucky folks and generally getting away from it all, is that it's also when Australia releases the Queen's Birthday Honours List. And in this case, we know a few people who have been added to the list. In fact, Chris Spurrou, Dave Jacker, both getting the Order of Australia Medal, and Dick Smith is being upgraded to Companion of the Order of Australia.
Now, Grant, are they getting those awards because those people have all been on the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast at one point in their lives?
I think it could be a contributing factor, mate, but Chris Spurrou was recognised for services to aerobatics, Dave Jacker for services to and promotion of the rights of quadriplegics and so on, and Dick Smith for everything that he does.
Yes, Dick Smith, very much into philanthropy amongst many, many other things he does. So great work there. And Chris Spurrou, well, you know what, Grant? Now, Chris Spurrou is a personal hero of mine, and I personally think he should have been knighted. Can we still do that?
I think this could be the first step towards it, but we'll just have to lobby the Governor-General and see if he can put in a good word to Liz while she's still in power, hey?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, so congratulations and well deserved to all of those people. And, you know, it's obviously, Grant, you know, there's many, many people that get these awards for, you know, all number of reasons, but, you know, significant to us, not only because we know these guys, but also because they've done some wonderful things, in particularly for aviation, if for nothing else, Grant.
That's right, mate. But meanwhile, we'd better get back onto the news of the day. And Qantas says they're still on track to buy the 787-9 Dreamliner.
Yes, and according to this article here in australianaviation.com.au, Grant, their chief executive, Alan Joyce, says that bringing in these 787-9 aircraft might in fact return the airline group to an investment-grade credit rating. Interesting.
Well, it's interesting because what had been there were suggestions out there that if they went and worked really hard to reacquire that investment-grade credit rating, that would in turn force them to delay buying the 787-9s because that money that they would have used to lock up the 787-9s would have to go into shoring up a whole lot of other areas to bring back that investment grade credit rating. But according to Mr. Joyce, he says the carrier can chew gum, walk and sing at the same time. And that's a quote. Basically, he's saying that they can get that investment grade credit rating and also pick up the 787-9s at the same time. So that's a fair bit of dancing around and indications that maybe Qantas is getting itself back in play.
Interestingly there, Grant, one of the criteria that they've set out as being essential to this is repaying $1 billion of debt. So that's a fair bit of debt for a relatively small airline on the world scale. But it would be good to see that obviously repaid. And, you know, I guess, Grant, the 787, I mean, they're always having to, you know, upgrade their fleet here and there, aren't they? So I guess as aircraft get older, they become more expensive to operate. And if all the figures that we see around the place about the 787 being as efficient as it apparently is, well, you know, perhaps that is a good move.
Well, it's definitely a good move to get into the Dash 9. It is, in my opinion, the better of the two 787s that are currently available. But look, the thing is, it's a major capital outlay. It's a major commitment and so on. And they need to get these aircraft in to help reduce their fuel burns and their operational costs. But it's a major capital expense. So what everyone's saying is that, well, if you do that, you're not going to have the money that you need to invest in the future to pay down your debt, get your balance sheet back in order, get returns back to shareholders. You're not going to be able to do both, is what some of the analysts are saying. Joyce is saying that's rubbish and that Qantas can actually do both. It can actually get the 787-9s and bring itself back to a investment grade credit rating. So I don't know, mate. We'll see what comes through. There's, you know, lies, damn lies, statistics, and corporate tax returns. So we'll see what happens with the when the profits come out and how they've managed to wangle this one to be able to juggle both.
Yeah, absolutely. And Qantas holds options for around 50 of these aircraft now. Of course, as we reported a year or two back, I guess now they delayed those options for quite some time. Although the Jetstar fleet has been taking on 787-8s for you know, the last year or so, and they seem to be quite happy with those from what I can hear around the place. It'll be interesting to see when Qantas takes that up. The first 787-9 option is due for delivery in late 2017, so not that far away in the grand scheme of things, Grant. And speaking of 787-9s, just as an aside here, I note with interest that Etihad Airways has indeed started operating the 787-9 of their own into Brisbane via Singapore from Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. We've been waiting for them to arrive. Interesting that they're staging through Singapore, but also very cool paint scheme on the Etihad's aircraft these days. That it's rather geometric. Some of people have said, oh, they don't like it. I don't know. I think it's pretty cool.
I think it looks really good. In fact, Grant, I'm looking at another article here. They've been very busy, Etihad, in this part of the world recently. And in fact, recently they also started flying an A380 service into Sydney, and that also has the same new Etihad scheme. And I reckon it looks really good, actually.
Yeah, I reckon. But something that isn't looking that good going forward, according to the Air Traffic Controllers Union, is that maybe we shouldn't actually be going ahead with this new proposal from CASA to set up Unicom systems at various regional airports that don't require people to have previously held an air traffic controllers certificate in the previous 10 years.
Well, that's really interesting, Grant, because, you know, I've been flying now since 1990, and I've used lots of Unicoms over that time, and you know what? I've never held an air traffic control qualification.
Well, this is more for the people on the ground giving the advice and information to pilots rather than the pilots themselves having a chat with the Unicom guys. Basically, it's for remote locations that have RPT traffic but don't have a control tower. And it would allow people, for instance, the aircraft firefighters units or other folks such as mechanics or people nominated by the airport to receive training and then provide a Unicom service so they can advise on traffic in the area, what's happening, what the weather's like, conditions, all those kind of things. And I think this is a great idea. If they're properly trained and given the skill set and the tools and so on they'll need to be able to provide a Unicom service, then this can only benefit safety. But of course, this is a demarcation issue, and Civil Air, the union representing air traffic controllers, has registered its opposition to the decision because they're saying anyone exercising an air traffic function has to have the training and experience of an air traffic controller, according to Civil Air Executive Secretary Peter McGuane.
Yes, well, demarcation, I guess it is their job to represent their members, and I guess that's what they're saying there is, you know, obviously we'd like you to, at great expense, build more control towers so we can have a, you know, a fully controlled piece of airspace there. But, you know, a lot of airports that regular public transport flights from the airlines operate in and out of around Australia, well, they're not really busy enough to justify having a tower service. So what are you left with? You're left with a sort of a Unicom service, and it is just an advisory. I mean, you know, that's the way Unicom works. It's an advisory. It's not a traffic control per se. In fact, Grant, as we were talking about before we started recording, when I used to fly in America when I was doing my license, and yes, this was a long time ago, but I think I used to get Unicom advisories from the local ANP mechanic at the airport I used to fly in and out of. So
yeah, well, I mean, my take is if they're properly trained and know what they're doing, I've got no problem with it. And if the air traffic controllers union wants to raise up a stink, then how about they start putting some of their people out there to run the Unicom? Of course, they're going to charge a fortune, and the airport won't like it, and it'll all be charged back onto the people. I mean, as one person has been quoted as saying, the requirement to have held an air traffic controller certificate within the previous 10 years to operate a Unicom is a great way to ensure that retired air traffic controllers still can have a job. And you know, that's all very well and good, but some of these locations that want to set up Unicoms, no air traffic controller who's retired or even current wants to be there. It's, you know, it's not just Ballina and other places like that. Some of them are out in the boonies and, you know, in the mining areas and so on. It'd be fantastic to have this extra safety provided. And I think the Civil Air, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, should be getting right onto it and saying it's a great idea for safety, provided it's done correctly, and let us help you make sure it's done correctly.
Yeah, in fact, if they were really smart about it, Grant, they could charge for the privilege.
There you go.
Make some money.
I mean, you know, it's sort of like the deep thought thing. You know, if you guys get yourselves canny agents, you'll be on the gravy train for life. But oh no, these guys decide to go down the old path of just blocking anything that looks bad to their eyes. I mean, get with the times, guys. Realize that you're going to win more friends if you actually support these new ideas and make sure they're done constructively in a way that benefits you rather than just blocking them.
And interestingly, Grant, I notice here in this article that we're reading this from in The Australian, one of the chief agitators here in favour of this plan is Dick Smith, who we just mentioned a little earlier. So a very controversial figure in some sectors, some might say. Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. I suppose we'll have to go back to work. Well, look, Grant, it's only a four-day work week, so that's not such a bad thing, is it?
Yeah, mate, four-day work week. I've heard of them. I don't know. I've been working every day across the long weekend anyhow. What's this holiday thing?
I don't know. Well, I just took one. So and before Grant kills me, until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the smarting Grant McCarran. Excuse me, Steve, was this your knife?
Rob, what can you tell us about Unicom?
We want to know. Unicom is essentially a service that that they use at airports that don't have control towers, and it's usually a well known marked frequency, and people just call in and say, "Hey, Hartsfield Airport, Cessna 6927 Golf, we're 5 miles south landing. What runway are you using?" And somebody might be on the other end and have a little wind sock or a wind indicator in there and say, "Well, you know, airplanes seem to be using runway 27. The winds are out of the west at 7 knots." And that's about all they do, because they don't have the ability to look out a window. They may be in an office, in a line shack. So it's not like they're really going to separate airplanes or anything like that. So
who provides that service?
Well,
in the U.S. anyway,
these local airports, the airport itself will do it. They'll just have a radio that's on to that same frequency, so that when people call in, somebody can answer them and give them basically a little picture of what's going on. And basically, what you're trying to do is prevent someone from using runway 27 when everybody's landing on 9. That's about all you can do, at least here in the States, is suggest. They don't control anything.
Okay, interesting. Hey, a few shout-outs. First off, and this might be the last time we announce this because time is getting close. Remember June 20th, 2015. That Saturday is the date for the Innovations in Flight Family Day and Outdoor Aviation Display at the Stephen F. Uvarhazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia, at the National Air and Space Museum. Website is innovationsinflight.si.edu. Check that out. That's an event that you want to attend if you can, and you may even see us there if you do.
And especially if the geeks want to support us and go to airplanegeeks.com and click on the Donate Now button, they can help sponsor us.
That's right. That'd be very helpful. Much appreciated. Also, we have a birthday coming up. Did you know that, Rob?
Do you mean me particularly, or?
How about
no, happy something birthday much, to much
us.
Younger?
Happy birthday to us.
That's right. On June 10th, Airplane Geeks turns 7 years old, if you can believe that. Yeah.
Wow.
I know.
Congratulations to you. And a big shout out to Courtney for starting this 7 years
absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. It feels short to us. It probably feels like forever for our wives. Although I don't know, Rob. Maybe yours likes the fact that for 7 years she's been able to count on you being out of her hair for a couple of hours every Monday evening.
Hmm. You know, that's a very interesting point. I don't think I ever thought of that.
I'm sure she has. Oh, I know my wife has. No, that's not true, actually. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We heard from Paul Isaacs in New Zealand. He says, "Hi, guys. Listening to your last podcast, I heard someone mention that it would be neat to see some commercial aircraft doing some formation maneuvers." So he sent us a link to five Airbus A350s flying together. This is on YouTube. We'll put a link in the show notes. The description is the five test and development A350-900s took to the skies for a formation flight. This was in September 2014, bringing together all the aircraft used for Airbus' successful campaign, leading to certification of this latest Airbus wide-body jetliner. It's a great video. I don't know if you guys saw this. It's really well-produced.
Professionally. I did. And I think what's really interesting is that they give you a pretty good look at how they worked together long before they made the flight to make sure that it was going to be done safely. And there's a lot of interaction there with the pilots of all of the airplanes and the chase planes and everything else.
Yeah,
I was going to say, although it certainly wasn't the precision of the Blue Angels, it was still pretty spectacular to see such large aircraft so close. So my question to Rob really is, if you had the chance to do that flying, would you do that?
Well, you know, years ago, I would have said, oh, sure, piece of cake. But now that I know what I know about having flown in formation
and been in the back seat of airplanes watching how they do it, it ain't near as easy as it looks.
Yeah, and there was definitely some impressive footage on that YouTube clip. Nice.
Well, we also heard from our good friend, Stephen Thornbloom. Stephen lives, I think, Brian, on your edge of the country.
Somewhere on the left coast.
Okay. Somewhere on the left coast.
Okay.
Stephen writes, in regards to episode 350, where you talked about the United flight that had to divert because of an autistic girl having a meltdown, he says, I wanted to share the following two links with you to share on the podcast. And Stephen, I'm really, really glad you sent these along. This is really good stuff. The first link is to a Wings for Autism events that JetBlue have held in Boston and in Burbank. And Stephen, of course, is a JetBlue employee.
And that is right next door to me.
It is. And it is. The idea here was to help families practice the travel experience. So basically what they did is allow families to come in with their autistic children or I guess others and walk them through the process in advance of them ever taking a flight on an airplane. So instead of the first flight being the first experience, this let these people with autism go through the experience in advance so that it would be more comfortable for them when it was really the case. So that's a link that we'll have. It's from the JetBlue blog, Burbank's first ever Wings for Autism event. We'll put that in the show notes. Please look at that. And then the second link he sent was, this is an article that was written about, he says, a woman and her autistic son and what JetBlue did for them. So we have that link as well. So some really great stuff. We've talked about autistic passengers on airlines here and there over the years. I think what JetBlue is doing here is brilliant. What a great thing to do.
There's a way to do it right and there's a way to do it wrong, and there it seems like going above and beyond in doing it right.
Yeah, and I mean, how hard is it really? I mean, and this is something that,
well, apparently very, which is really sad.
Yeah, apparently. But I know we have a number of listeners, obviously, in airlines, and also we have a number of folks listening who operate airports. And it seems to me like this would be a really great project for, either of them to undertake, do a good thing and, really help the situation in the long run. So thanks to Stephen for sending those in. Scott wrote us. Scott is a retired Army aviator, some 23 years. He says he really enjoyed Rob's look back at his time in the Air Force. That was from our Bits and Pieces episode. If you haven't listened to that yet, go give that a listen. Scott says it brought back my own memories as young Army Lieutenant Scout pilot stationed in Schweinfurt, Germany in the early 80s. He said had lots of great adventures, missions, and seen many wonderful and historical sites, but also worked with a bunch of great fellow soldiers. And yes, we did our job as professionals. We sure did some wacky stuff. As time goes by, those memories started to fade away, and I sure wish I had a camera with me more than I did to capture all those great moments. So he wanted to share one story about the BAE Lightning Fighter. He says, in the summer of 1985, we flew a group of OH-58 Scouts and AH-1S Cobras to England to work with the Air Force A-10s for a week at RAF Woodbridge, which was another fun adventure, he says. While we were there, RAF Bentwaters...
RAF! It's not RAF! It's R-A-F.
I know. They don't like RAF, do they?
No.
Maybe the Australians like RAF, but okay, I'll switch. The RAF Bentwaters, thank you, Rob.
It's Bentwaters, not Brentwaters.
Oh, there's no R in there, is there?
No, no.
I'm getting it all wrong.
Max, will you read what's written there, please?
RAF Bentwaters had an open house where we participated as part of the static display. The best part of the show was the solo flight display of a BAE Lightning. It was just crazy and loud, and for his final act, he did a low-level high-speed pass over the crowd line, not the runway, but over the heads of the spectators lining the fence. I do mean low level. It was awesome. Loud and low. I love that stuff. I guess we're a little more safety conscious now than back then.
Yeah, I was going to say right over your head, though.
I know, but still, I bet the crowd went wild.
It'd be impressive.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, that's what they did. In fact, is we were at the sister station to Woodbridge, which was at Weathersfield, which was west of Woodbridge, and when they had those local air shows, you have to realize this is, you know what, almost 50 years ago. I mean, they did things a little differently than they do now. I mean, sure. They'd have the F-100s, which were, you know, that was America's first supersonic airplane, and they would come across the grass 20 feet in front of the crowds at, you know, 480 knots or something, and they'd be gone before you even heard them, but it was so cool.
One thing about being in the military is great stories. Scott actually sent a PS because he thought of another story that was fun. He said, as we were flying to England, crossing the English Channel and heading right for the White Cliffs of Dover, we were initially in a nice formation of OH-58s in the lead and the AH-1s behind. Us scouts were holding a nice V formation, thinking the Cobras were doing the same, until about halfway across, we noticed off to the side, our Cobra pilots were making gun runs on the ships below. Makes you wonder if those sailors were thinking, or what they were thinking, seeing those crazy Cobra pilots heading their way. The commander was not too pleased, I'm sure, but probably thought it was to be expected from his gun pilots.
Yeah, I think that's an oh crap moment.
I know. Oh, man. Having fun with boys and toys, I guess. But
Well, you know, Scott brought back a memory for me because when I was I had read that when I was in Brussels last week, I ended up sitting next to a fellow working for Boeing who was a Brit. And it turned out he was an RAF test pilot years and years ago. But he'd flown the Lightnings, and I said, "Oh, you know, I talked to him a little bit about my experience, and then the fact that this, you know, that Scott mentioned this issue about the Lightnings. Oh, so they were wonderful airplanes. They did wonderful things. They just couldn't go very far because they didn't carry a lot of gas, but they were really neat."
Oh, that's great. That's great. Aviation brings people together and generates lots of great stories. All right. Well, with that, I think that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You've been listening
goodbye.
To episode 353. Rob's in a rush to get out.
Yeah, you've been listening to Rob breathe.
I know. Find us. Yeah. Rob's on a different microphone this episode. And yeah, it's a bit of a challenge for him. All right, Rob, if you can, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes, that's airplanegeeks.com/353. We want to thank our guest, Anthony Nolle. He's the executive producer and director of The Aviators. Find them at theaviators.tv. You can find us on, well, the usual places, Twitter, Airplane Geeks on Twitter, on Facebook, same, Google+. We're also on Stitcher.com and TuneIn Radio. If you want to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So I want to thank you guys for being here as always. Rob, I'm afraid to, where can people find you online, Rob?
Well, let's see. I'm back in the States now, and I'm staying here for a while. So JetWine on Twitter and JetWine on Facebook and, of course, JetWine on the blog. And, gosh, I don't know where else. Here, certainly, and we'll have an aviation minute finally next week. I mean, we're getting back into the swing of things, and we'll be outside of Brian's house next week with our drone, keeping an eye on what Brian's doing in his free time.
Yeah, lots of luck trying to find me here.
I don't know. I wouldn't put it past Rob with a drone. But otherwise, Brian, how do folks reach you?
Oh, they could find me at the local airport because I seem to be flying an awful lot this year. But electronically, it's Brian@airplanegeeks.com.
All right. That's it for us. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely. Oh, I can't.
Oh, you can't. Oh, because you're on your thing. Okay.
Wait. Actually, I've got call recorder going here. It'll record something, but it's only. I think it's only going to record me.
That's okay.
Do you want that?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Let me grab that here.
Brian, and then that way later you could listen to yourself breathe.
Well, it's actually good to put myself to sleep. To listen to me.
It puts us to sleep.
Yeah.
Sorry. I know. That was too easy. You guys ready for the Australia desk?
Do you know I had a TV commercial recently, Grant?
I believe so. It was something about boats.
That's right. I am now an expert on boating, apparently.
Well done, dude. Never been in one in your life, but now you're an expert. Woo!
No, I've been down the beach this weekend. I saw one.
Oh, God, dude, oh, you're a guru. You're not just an expert. Okay, let's see if we can squeeze all this in by just doing things as quick and short and sweet as we can, right?
Sure. Yeah. We say that every week. Let's go.
Hey, all you cats and kittens out there in Airplane Geeks Land. It's the 8th of June, 2015, and this is the Short, Sharp, and Sweet Australia Desk.
Was that your intro?
I just thought I'd throw it in there and see what you thought.
Oh, okay.
Rob, what can you tell us about Unicom? Rob's on mute. Rob, are you on mute?
Or he went to grab dinner.
Oh, man, I gotta, you know, wow. Man, I'm like a couple of great beers on a break. Yeah. Oh, God, am I on the air? Oh, I mean, I'm here, guys.
All right. Well, a couple of shout outs.
And I wasn't really drinking on my break. I was just kidding.
Well, if you were drinking on your break, that's okay.
Okay.
If it improves the quality of the content, anything goes.
Well, you know, after listening to the Australian guys, who knows?
Okay.